Today on the 21st, we're talking poetry and politics. The poet laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera, talks to us about his Chicano roots, immigrants today, and how all of these stories inform his work.
Words to me are like musical instruments, and each word for me is, like a set of notes. Like with the word chisme has that S and Z sound, that C-H, chisme.
And he shares what it was like to move with his family to the U.S. as a child.
And it was more of a great adventure. It was also a big part. It was moving out of almost complete poverty, even though I see my parents as pioneers. So it was a time of pioneering. It was also a time of zero resources.
And as we do on Mondays, we'll bring you the latest in Illinois politics, catch you up on everything that happened over the weekend. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Good morning. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Special thanks to Scott Cameron and Brian Moline for filling in for me while I was out. It's great to be back home. Juan Felipe Herrera is the 21st Poet Laureate of the United States. He's in the middle of his second term, holding the nation's highest honorary poetry position. Before this, he was also the Poet Laureate of California. Herrera is America's first Latino poet laureate. He's also a performance artist and an activist. He was in Urbana earlier this year and joined me in studio. Herrera grew up as a child of migrant workers. To start, I asked him about the farmland he saw on his drive to Champaign and whether that reminded him of his childhood.
There's a lot of farmland, a lot of green, the color green. I love the color green. And it does, even though my childhood was many years ago, it doesn't go away and things continue. There's a lot of farm workers. And when we hang out, we're still the same. We're still going through the same kind of struggles and the same beauty also.
And I wanted to ask you about your family and your parents, because we're taking part on the 21st. It's a project called Redream, and it's a collection of public media stations that are talking about how the American dream has changed. I wanted to ask you not just why your family came, but what was your parents' dream of when they came here?
Well, dream is a good word, and I like that. I like that word. I believe in that word. At the same time, it was more of a great adventure. It was also part a big part. It was moving out of almost complete what's called poverty, even though I see my parents as pioneers. So it was a time of pioneering. It was also a time of zero resources. So it's moving into where there could be more resources and being a pioneer to open new horizons and new roads for the children and the family and to reconnect with established family networks. It's not like we never were in California or we were never in the United States. This is Mexican land and Mexican Indian land. So, and it continues to be. Things have changed, of course. So it's there's a lot of other things going on. But indeed, there's also a dream involved that hopefully things will get better and change.
And that was your parents' dream when they relocated here?
That was
Mexico.
My parents, part of my parents' experience. My father came here in the late 1890s. He was born in 1882. And my mother came from Mexico City and right after the Mexican Revolution. So, before the Mexican Revolution, before the trembling and disassemblage of Mexico into a better place, and also after the Mexican Revolution and the great excitement and turmoil, also suffering, excitement, turmoil, and blood and happiness, all those things mixed together. You get on a train or you get on a bus or by horseback or you walk from Mexico City all the way to Juarez, so the borderline, and then somehow you get across and get to El Paso, where it's a different arrangement, and dreams are possible. But, of course, they can only go so far sometimes, and we need more social action to make things happen.
I want to talk to you about that, about how you think the dream has changed. But I wanted to ask you about that background. I wanted to go back to you saying you love the color green. When your parents came here, I wonder if we could talk about sort of just your earliest memories of green and farmland and working. I wonder what those stories were like.
Well, it was being immersed in change and being immersed in being in my father's early 40s army truck that he drove, in a giant army truck, him and my mother and myself, and stopping here and there for them to work in various fields, and whether it was grapes or drying peaches into dry peaches.
And you remember that?
I remember the fields and colors and the landscapes. And the rest is storytelling that my mother would tell me, or just seeing my father take off with his implements, his grape-picking knives, which are sharp, curled, eagle-like clawed knives.
Okay.
And so part of it is a kind of visual experience in our one-room trailer. And the other is through stories, and the other one is just visual, being in the flow of migrant action from ranch to ranch and little town to little town and being on the roads.
Well, there must have been so much community involved with that as well, though. Was there?
There's community once you get to the actual work site. But, you know, I only remember one occasion. What I remember are the people themselves, a few people that my father and mother, you know, talked to and hung out with, or that came to the trailer. My mother healing the women with certain oils, visiting their little trailer, you know, like across the yard, we would say. But so she would visit and provide, you know, massage and healing, you know, activities for them because they were in pain, young women. And then meeting people on occasion in the mountains where my father worked too, in Southern California, and farm workers that would, after a week of work, maybe on a Saturday, they would gather in a certain nook in the mountain and have a little fiesta, but only campesinos, only farm workers would be there, and a sweet flour tortilla, small sweet flour tortillas. And kind of hanging out and talking and having these the food like that.
I'm speaking with Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the poet laureate of the United States. And as you were talking about your childhood, I think your poetry carries a lot of visual observations of hard labor. And I wonder if we can talk about that a little bit. I mean, what your personal experience with that was, or how much of it was just observation as well?
Well, you know, you're right. I grew up as an observer and a listener, because when you're moving in the migrant trail, it's a lot of observation. It's kind of hyper-observation because it's a new place, and you're moving to a new place. You're leaving a almost familiar place, and you look back and you see little families and a little doggy that I made a friend with called Rowdy, little black and white hound. He was trying to catch my father's trailer.
Aww.
And he was going.
And you had to leave him?
And he had to leave him. He wasn't mine, but we were buddies. So those are the some visual moments. And then on that road, just in front of you, nothing on it, just dirt and or a one-lane highway and the open land on the side. There was not much. California wasn't like the California now. And the California now wasn't like the California then. It was open.
How is it different?
Oh, it's just totally it's totally congested.
So urban now.
It's just totally urban. It's the whole from Crescent City, North Califas or Eureka or Ukiah, or further up, all the way down to San Diego, San Isidro.
In the past couple of years, it's green also, I would imagine, with the drought.
The
right?
green is mostly gone. The green is in the hope that people still have.
I wanted to go back to one of your older books. And
okay.
I think people always use the term prolific with you because you've written so many different things. Do you have a number? I feel like everyone says dozens.
It's about 30.
They're about 30.
Around 30, yes.
I wanted to ask you about 187 reasons Mexicanos can't cross the border, because use this term outlaw and brown in the U.S. And I wanted to, before we get to those reasons, I wanted to ask, first of all, describe what you mean if you're calling yourself an outlaw, that term.
Well, you know, that term's come up before. I think it could be in the introduction by Stephen Kessler. Brown, of course, you know, of course
sure.
I am brown. But, you know, different shades of brown also.
Yeah, me too. I'm another shade of brown, right.
I don't know, you know, sometimes I'm kind of green brown. Sometimes I'm kind of light brown, and sometimes I'm kind of dark brown. So I don't even know what dark means anymore. And brown is good. You know, brown, you know, we're all brown. You know, we all get kissed by the sun. So I don't think I've used the word outlaw. But it's all right. You know, being on the outside looking in, I have definitely experienced that, being on the outside looking in, even today, you know, and these days, even as you know, even now in my life, on many occasions I still feel outside of the center of things.
Well, and as you say, as a poet, you're also an observer. I wonder if you can apply your observation skills to this current political climate and to the presidential election and to when we hear presidential candidates like Donald Trump saying, you know, they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crimes, they're rapists, describing Mexicans coming across the border. I mean, what is, how do you experience that?
Well, you know, I don't have any comments on the campaign or Trump. However, these are not new statements. And in my poetry, and as it is in all of Latina and Latino poetry, you'll find these concerns. You're going back as far as you want to go back in time, whether it's in the 30s, like in the Juarez poets, like Roberto Quintana, writing about the patron, the boss, and the quote-unquote peasant, and having a dialogue in one of his poems. And these have always been issues of power and culture. And I dedicated my whole life on writing about these kind of things, you know, being scapegoats, you know.
It's an interesting observation, though, that this is not a new conversation.
It's not a new conversation. I think for people of color and for people in the working class, scapegoatism, and we can use that word, is nothing new. And our working class citizenry in the United States literally works very hard and does all the jobs no one else wants. So we actually, in many ways, are the fuel of the agricultural business.
And when you say that, when you talk about working class conditions, I wanted to mention something to you as we're thinking about this area also. We have partners at WILL who investigate Midwest, and they actually went through inspection reports for 8 different migrant worker settlements throughout the region, and they found that workers were living in, I'm going to use a quote, blighted facilities, roaches, missing fire detectors, inadequate lighting and plumbing. I wonder, as you're thinking about 2016 and looking at these conditions, how you think that compares to how things have been in the past, and if you think things have changed.
Well, you know, there's a lot of changes. You know, things don't stay the same. And we do have the United Farm Workers Union. And a lot of the students and young people, the Dreamers, for example, we mentioned the term dream, they're very active and highly active. And they're fabulous activists and effective activists. And so is the Farm Workers Union, and so is MALDEF, Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. So there's a lot of new positive changes taking place, as well as other multi-agency nationwide coalitions, like the there's a Hispanic Leadership Coalition also, and many more. So there's a lot of good things that are positive and large and coalition centered that are taking place for the betterment and good of Latinos and Latinas and the working class and all of us in the United States. At the same time, as you just mentioned, you know, some things have apparently not changed, and this is something that Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, the Filipino workers unions. Worked for the change, the living conditions, the wages, the promotion, the abuses, and the pesticides, all those things. So it's something we all need to be more aware of and need to voice ourselves regarding what's going on. Otherwise, it will continue. It will stay in motion, and because it's not mentioned on the channels and in the media at large, it doesn't mean it's not taking place. So we are the new media.
And I think maybe, do you feel a part of your poetry is activism in the sense of shedding a light on those conditions?
You know, that I believe in that. You know, I believe in humanity, and I believe in social change for the better of everyone, you know, all colors, all classes. And I dedicate my life towards that. I also do, you know, experimental poetry, of course, and that's good. And experimental art, of course, that's good. And it's kind of the same thing, because I orient my life towards humanity, and that's a good thing, especially today.
Well, and I think you have such an interesting perspective. I wanted to ask you, when we think about your performance art, your poetry, your activism, you've been at the University of Illinois visiting the Department of Latina and Latino Studies. And I don't know if you're aware, the department made the front page of the newspaper recently because written on chalk on the sidewalk surrounding the building were quotes, "They must go back and build the wall." And, you know, we had students in Michigan who called the police when they saw similar messages on their college campuses. Where do you think free speech fits into this line of people saying, I wonder where you think the line is between free speech and hate speech and what people have a responsibility to do, especially on a college campus?
You know, well, you know, that line needs to be considered by all of us, you know, because that line can be stretched. Of course, it's free speech. However, we must speak up and we feel that free speech is hate speech, as opposed to just letting it be this generic free speech. You know, if we are disrespecting, if we are abusing, if we are using violent language, which that is, then we need to notice it, speak up, and change it. Otherwise, once again, we leave things the way they are, they will stay the way they are, and many people will be, abused and disrespected and experience, violent actions, which is language can be that.
That's Juan Felipe Herrera, the 21st Poet Laureate of the United States. He was in Urbana earlier this year. His latest book, by the way, is Notes on the Assemblage. Coming up on the 21st, we'll be continuing the conversation that I had with him. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about the automatic voter registration bill that Governor Rauner vetoed on Friday and the news conference that was just held in Chicago, just ended maybe less than an hour ago, maybe half an hour ago, by groups that were denouncing the governor's veto. Amanda Vinicky and Laura Washington are going to be joining us for our regular Monday politics segment. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest in studio with me, the Poet Laureate of the United States, Juan Felipe Herrera. His latest work, Notes on the Assemblage. We're in studio talking about his life, his work, his activism. Would you read a poem for us? Do you have one ready there? I see you're flipping through. Okay, you can keep looking unless you've got one ready.
It's called Border Bus. And this is a bus that really is a border bus. It's filled with people, especially women, that have been detained at the border for not having papers, and they're put in this bus, and they're being taken. This bus is going, you know, to a particular city in Southern California, to be put in holding cells there, a detention center in that particular city, and the people of that city come out and don't want this border bus in their town, so they are protesting and they are blocking the entrance of the border bus. So that's what this piece is. I'm very concerned about it. I'm very concerned about that, about the experience of people being detained. I'm very concerned about the whole thing about not having papers and how people are perceived that cross the border and the condition their lives are in. ¿A dónde vamos? Where are we going? Speak in English or the guard is going to come. ¿A dónde vamos? Where are we going? Speak in English or the guard is going to get us, hermana. Pero qué hicimos? But what did we do? Speak in English. Come on. No más unas pocas palabras. I just know a few words. You better figure it out, hermana. The guard is right there. See the bus driver? Tantos días y ni sabíamos para dónde íbamos. So many days and we didn't even know where we were headed. I know where we're going, where we always go, to some detention center, to some fingerprinting hall or cube, some warehouse, warehouse after warehouse. Pero ya nos investigaron. Ya cruzamos y ya nos cacharon. Los federales del bordo, ¿qué más quieren? But they already questioned us. We already crossed over. They already grabbed us at the border patrol. What more do they want? We're in the bus now. That is all.
That's Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the poet laureate of the United States, the first Latino poet, and that's called Border Bus.
Border Bus.
How much time do you spend talking with women who have gone on these buses, talking to these families? I wonder how much of that came from you hearing stories from people.
It came from me hearing stories from people. Of course, you know, my mother and I traveled in buses, and my mother and I were questioned for papers when we got off the bus. My aunt.
Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Were you scared?
I didn't know what it was. I was scared. I didn't know what it was. Yes,
how
I was.
Old were you then?
Oh, you know, I was a kid, 7, 8.
Okay.
7, 8. Even younger than that, when I was 5, I saw my friends across. My father used to work for La Familia Garcia in Escondido, California. A little tiny plot of land with some corn. And he planted corn there and made a little crop for them happen because he was a campesino, a farm worker all his life since he was a kid. And somehow they owned this little plot of land, Mexicanos, and this little house they lived on. And then one day the Border Patrol came and took them one by one. So I was 5 years old. And my whole family, of course, has this experience. Told in not dire, in a dire, gloomy voice, told in a voice of, this is our experience.
This is your family's story.
This is my family story.
Yeah.
And of course, I see children on the road here as a poet laureate and audiences. And they say, question and answer time, Q&A time. And they raise their hand, 11-year-old. I said, yes. He goes, I want to know how to write a story. Oh, okay. Well, I said, maybe you can tell me what kind of story you're writing and I can be more focused. He goes, well, you know, I'm writing a story about children that are abandoned because their parents were deported. And I wasn't expecting that. And then I said, well, why don't you come up to the stage with me and tell us more about yourself? Because I felt that this 11-year-old boy needed to have a forum to present who he was and what he wanted to speak about and write about.
Did you start writing as a way to share your story?
I started writing because I just I got so curious about it. You know, when you're so young, you don't really think about a cause. I was just so young, you know, I was...
You were thinking, I need to express myself. You just wanted to write. You needed to write. Did you?
I probably did, you know. My teacher started talking about making sentences in eighth grade. My mother always told stories and sang out poems and performed in the trailer.
When you were traveling?
When I was a kid, yeah, as we traveled, because she had wanted to be a theater artist, but she was taken out of school in third grade. She came from the hardest times you can imagine after the Mexican Revolution and across the border. So she had this great love of knowledge and of art. So I kind of had her electricity. She kind of shot out that electricity at me, just physically.
Oh, well, it sounds like all of that creative energy as well, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because we're reading, as you were reading Border Bus, it's in English and Spanish. And I wonder how... in terms of how your brain works being bilingual for writing poetry, because I think I'm not bilingual, but my Spanish is good enough. And I think when you speak enough of another language, there are certain words, like I was thinking, like the word chisme, it just sounds so much better than saying gossip, right? You just say chisme. And I think that's something probably everybody who grows up in Miami uses that word a lot. Is that how it works for you? Or there are certain words you just think this needs to be in Spanish, or this phrase needs to be in Spanish, or this has to be in English?
You're right. You know, the words to me are like musical instruments. And each word for me is like a set of notes. It's like when the word chisme has that S and Z sound, and that CH chisme, and it has an M in it, and it has a great sound.
It's a great word to say.
It's a great word to say. And ojalata is another great word, a tin, like, you know, that you, a tin plate or a sheet of tin. Ojalata. Because I'm bilingual, to me, it's actually one language now. It's one language with Spanish, English, and different kinds of Spanish and different kinds of English, and a whole multitude of a whole Fort Knox or Fort Chicharron or Fort Cilantro.
But it's
of
also
words.
But it's also for you. It sounds like it's the rhythm and the sound of the words in a way. It's much more a musical thing as well.
It is. It's rhythms and sounds
as opposed to necessarily the meaning. But I guess it's all of that, right?
Of course, as opposed to the meaning. Sometimes I push the meaning forward. And sometimes I push the sounds and images forward. And it's not a big old conscious kind of planning, strategic blueprint. But it kind of happens naturally in my mind and in my body. I go, yeah, you know, ooh, I'm going to write this one in Spanish. Wow, yeah, I can feel it. I can see it. I'm going to use a lot of animals and witches. And, you know, I'm going to get, this is going to be like a curandera, like a healer poem in Spanish. And then I'll go and I'll have, I'll kind of know what words I'm going to use without knowing them, because I'm going to bring in words like lagarto, like lizard.
Well, it's such an interesting thing with languages. You're talking about this because I'm thinking that's how language has, especially between Spanish and English, evolved in the U.S. If you think, because I say to people, I speak Spanglish fluently. And people ask me, I say, well, I speak Spanglish, yeah, if you really want to know. And that is a really interesting way to think about how a lot of communication is happening now.
You know, that's how it happens. As a matter of fact, as of right now, you're hereby pronounced a hardcore Chicana.
Great, thank you.
In addition to your other identities. You know, that's how it is. All languages are ish. All languages are ish languages. You know, English has a billion roots and a billion languages. You know, Germanic and Latin and on. And even Nahuatl, even Aztec, like the word chocolate comes from chocolatl, and that's an Aztec bona fide Mesoamerican term. It's not an English term, but it's become an English term, which is fabulous, but it actually has Aztec roots. So everything is ish.
What's your writing process like for you? Do you write every day? Is it, you do?
I write every day. As soon as I see a piece of paper or an interesting looking pen like this Micron 2, I go, I like the pen. Oh, I just can't wait to write with it. Or I like the color.
So you write by hand.
I write by hand also. I'm kind of a 60, well, I used to be like 60-10, all right. Like a 90% time on the computer.
Okay.
And then 10% on journal. And now I've become like 80% on journal and 20% on the computer. But there, if it's a book that I'm working on, I got to go to the computer because it'll save it and it's legible. Because since I like to draw and use colors and scribble, I believe in scribble. I'm a scribble believer.
you should put a book out of that.
I am. It's called Jabberwocking.
Okay.
It's called Jabberwocking. How to write a fast poem in a fast world.
That's great. Uh-huh. I'm speaking with Juan Felipe Herrera. He's the Poet Laureate of the United States. And I have to ask you a question, especially as we were talking about, or before the break, we were talking about making a living. And I don't know if you know this. Do you know when you Google poet laureates, one of the top searches is how much money does a poet laureate make? And then, so of course, because it auto-filled that for me, I wanted to know how much you make, and I looked it up as a poet laureate. I'm sure you have a lot of positions.
It's a lot of money, let me tell you.
Can you tell everybody how much it is?
It's an incredible amount of money. It's around $35,000
a year. $35,000 a year for a stipend, I think is what they call it.
It's a stipend.
Which I think is a much more appropriate way to say than a salary. For the poet laureate of the United States.
It pays travel. It's travel and hotel money. And it only goes up. It only goes so far. The hotels are so expensive.
How hard is it to make a living as a poet if you're the poet laureate of the United States? And
if you start thinking about it, you're not going to get there. You know, all my life I've been writing poetry and expanding it into theater and performance and community, working with communities and farm workers and farm worker children and migrant communities and students and children, gifted classes, so-called not gifted classes. Diabetes workshops, poems, workshops for women, et cetera, which I love to do, all of those. So I never thought about if I was going to make a living. I thought about what good can I do for people and how I can encourage them to tell their story and to get into writing. And women that cross the border thousands of miles south of the border and made it to the United States and finally got into a writing project at the Austin Learning Academy, for example, where I taught online and in person. And I didn't think I was going to learn, teach at in that space, but it came to me because I've been writing a while and bilingual. And someone says, do you want to do this? I go, of course I do. So there I was. And of course I got paid for that. It wasn't a lot of money, but it helped me take care of bills. So it's all these stepping stones. You know, you have to step on one stone to get to the next one.
As you say that, stepping stones, I wanted to play this project I was telling you we were part of. It's called Redream. and it's talking about how the American dream has changed. And I think a lot of our conversation has kind of touched on this. I wanted you to hear these stories and get your reaction to them.
The American dream. White picket fences, 2.78 kids and a dog. It's a dream we once shared. What is success to you? What dreams do you chase?
To work a job that's going to make a difference in somebody else's life.
For many, higher education means social mobility.
People can come from anywhere, and if you're willing to work hard enough, you can have it all.
But there are still people that are left behind for a lot of different reasons. There's room, a lot of room for improvement across the board.
That's part of the ReDream Project, which is a collection of videos of stories all across America of people sharing their dream. And I think as you listen to that, we have so much of a myth of if you work hard enough, you can accomplish your American dream. Do you think that's the case in this country today?
Well, you know, it's good to have dreams, and I support everybody on this project and everyone who wants to better the lives of others and their lives and the lives of their families. That's very important. That's beautiful. At the same time, you know, let us also think about all people should have abundant resources so that their dream is not limited to just resources. You know, they should be available. School should be available. Preschool should be available. Toddler resources should be available. Resources for women and childcare should be available. Insurance and counseling and education should be available so that they don't have to be the dreams. You know, I'm kind of pointing to something kind of odd. I'm just saying that all this should be available. These dreams already should be in place.
That shouldn't be a dream. That should be a reality.
That should be
saying.
A reality, you know. But it's good that it's a dream also, you know. Everything is fine. Everything's positive. Let's have those dreams to attain those resources. At the same time, let us be aware that to keep people without resources and have them struggling their whole life just to have resources and not really be able to be like my mom who said, who never had a chance to be a singer because she was kind of trapped in a world without resources.
And we started this conversation with you talking about your parents coming here and working as migrant workers for you, for your dream. And you have gone from that to being the poet laureate of the United States, the first Latino poet laureate of the United States. Do you feel like you've reached your American dream? Do you think?
Well, you know, my dream is for others. My dream is for others. I'm here because so many people brought me here. If it would have been just myself, I would probably be eating just a quesadilla on 14th and C Street in San Diego, where I used to have an apartment. We used to live in a small apartment. I probably would be there. I'd probably be doing art. That'd be great. But many people have brought me here. Of course, my parents, how hard they worked, and all the mentors I've had, friends that I've had, artists that I've known, teachers that I've known, people in arts communities and institutions that have supported me, and on, you know, yourself and people in radio and media that have given me a chance to speak on programs and newspapers who covered what I'm doing or were interested in me. And even when I was a little half taco, when I was just, you know, a Johnny poet, when I was Juanito poet, and they would invite me to a show and ask me good, cool questions. And so all those people brought me here to this table with you, and you are taking me further as well. So I thank you, and I thank everyone. But my dream is for others, and people have brought me here in many numbers. I thank all of them.
Juan Felipe Herrera, Poet Laureate of the United States. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Governor Rauner signs one bill to help sexual assault victims and vetoes another that would make voter registration automatic. Senator Mark Kirk is attacking Representative Tammy Duckworth on Iran in a new ad that's airing throughout central Illinois starting today. As we do on Mondays, we're catching up on Illinois politics and everything that's happened over the weekend. My guests today are Laura Washington. She's a columnist with Chicago Sun-Times, a political analyst for ABC 7 in Chicago, and joins us on the line from Chicago. Hi, Laura.
Good morning, Nyla. How you doing?
Good morning. Also with us is Amanda Vinicky, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. Amanda's joining us from Springfield. Hey, Amanda, how are you doing?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks.
Good morning. Let's start with this automatic voter registration bill, because I want to play a little bit of where we're at with this, because last week, Governor Rauner vetoed a bill on Friday that would have made voter registration in Illinois automatic. Let's hear what he said about why he vetoed it.
We need to clean up the bill. I think we can get it done with some proper modification. What we try to do is give the feedback through the media to the legislature. Here are the tweaks. I think there were six or seven changes that we'd recommend to make it comply with federal election law.
An hour ago, a coalition of groups, including the bill's main proponent, Cook County Clerk David Orr, held a news conference in Chicago to express their dismay at the governor's veto. Here's State Representative Carol Ammons as she pointed out the first African-American woman voted in to represent her Champaign-Urbana district.
It's no coincidence that as women and minorities are gaining representation as elected officials, utilizing the voting rights to influence party direction and policy choices, there has been a concerted effort to roll back the clock. This veto is in line with that effort.
That audio, by the way, we got from David Orr's Twitter feed. They were periscoping the press conference. David Orr says he's not buying that Governor Rauner says it needs more work. Representative Ammons said we may have to do this in veto session. Amanda, let's start with you. What else did Governor Rauner say about why he vetoed the bill? Was this a surprise?
You know, it was clear that there was some hesitancy. We heard from Rauner going in that he supports the concept, this notion of automatic voter registration, and it's not out. It's not uncommon for him to say we're studying it before he actually takes any sort of action on a measure. But yeah, we just, you know, had gotten word from the office that it seemed as if he had some issues. And if you look at the vote total, some of the Republicans going in had voted against the measure because they said then that it was flawed. Those were the issues that Governor Bruce Rauner presented. And he, in fact, had this summer signed a measure that is ostensibly going to, you know, clean up the voter rolls, make it easier for people to register, et cetera. He said this simply runs afoul of federal law and that it's overburdensome in terms of what it requires of the state, that if, for example, you have somebody who maybe goes to get access government benefits and it's at one address, but then they have a different Illinois address or something, then it would mess up their voter registration, put them into a bit of a pickle, and government would have to figure it out, and that it should be something that instead, he says, a voter should say, I want to be registered, and this is where I want to be registered.
Laura Washington, your thoughts on this? Because we often hear Republican Party claims that voter registration, making it easier, they're opening it up to fraud. What do you think about this?
Well, of course, we know that there's been a long time debate between the Republican and Democratic parties over this, over open access or more access for voters and voters registration. And this is, it's been always seen as a political decision, particularly in states like this one, which is so diverse, because the perception is, or the assumption is, that more registration, more access to voter registration is going to benefit Democrats. So if you want to look at this simply, simplistically, you could look at it from that perspective. And his Rauner's opponents have also accused him of trying to basically delay the implementation of this law past the time when he will be running for reelection, again, with the assumption that it would add more Democrats to the voter rolls. But he seems to have some legitimate concerns, some very specific concerns. One of the other things he points out is the issue of citizenship and the issue of immigration and the fact that the state of Illinois would be responsible for screening to determine whether or not folks are citizens, and that the agencies that would do that screening wouldn't necessarily have access to citizenship information. So those are flaws that I haven't necessarily heard his opponents, the critics that spoke this morning, sort out other than to say that they think he's anti-immigrant. So it sounds like it's back to the drawing table, but David Orr and his group are going to be, they're saying they're going to be actively trying to overturn the veto this fall.
Amanda, what, I mean, that's what, and Carol Ammons did say we may have to do this in veto session. I wonder if you could remind us where the votes were at before. Certainly this was bipartisan, but as you said, not all Republicans voted for this. Are there enough votes to be able to overturn the governor's veto?
So if you recall, the General Assembly does have supermajority of Democrats, just enough Democrats that if they all stick together, then they would be able to overturn this or really any other veto by Governor Bruce Rauner. But then again, they haven't necessarily been able to do that, haven't been able to stick together. So that's really, I think, where this is going to come down to. As you noted, Republicans were divided, but we very much have gotten the sense that when the governor lays down the hammer and says, I want you to vote with me, GOP, they do, and even those who have on rare occasion broken off in ranks with him, this doesn't seem like the sort of thing where they would. What I think is, so yes, it would very much be, I mean, if they're going to deal with it anytime soon, that will have to be in veto session. Otherwise, this measure is dead, and they'll have to start over, perhaps by addressing some of those concerns. I do think that this is one of those things that's remarkable in terms of watching the Capitol, how you know that often things don't get straightened out in advance of a bill getting to the governor's desk because there are just, there's a divide over what the law should look like. That's part of where the governor's veto power comes in. And yet, this is the sort of thing that I think is telling in terms of the inability of the governor and legislature to really work together and be on the same page that these issues weren't sorted out beforehand.
It is, that is a good point, Amanda. And Laura, I wonder if it does sort of speak to a level of dysfunction that there's months spent on this bill and now the governor saying, nope, I'm going to veto it, back to work, when we have the clock of an actual election that's coming up in November.
Well, it's interesting. And of course, the proponents of this would say that he deliberately delayed his decision long enough to make it really difficult to get something through because we're going to a volatile election season when there's so much at stake and when there's going to be so many seats that are going to be up for grabs. And so no one's going to necessarily want to stick their necks out on these issues. And so the other thing I thought was curious was it seemed as though the governor was saying that he wanted to provide feedback through social media in a way. It sounds as though he was basically saying, I'm going to communicate my concerns about this legislation through the media and not, you know, what have they been doing for the last 6 or 7 months when they're supposedly were negotiating over this legislation? Are they not talking to each other?
That's a good question. Let's move on to something else. Amanda, Governor Rauner also signed a bill last week geared at reducing the backlog of rape kits that are yet to be examined in Illinois. Amanda, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I mean, this is really actually robust legislation. So it does everything from specialized training requirements for police officers, notification that hospitals have to make police aware when they are collecting a rape test kit and setting further timelines for when law enforcement needs to take care of those and get it tested. And part of that is because, as you noted, there has been this backlog, and that's something that I think is, you know, a front to any sort of advocates or just a lot of people in terms of you go through a sexual assault, go through getting this rape kit testing done, and that is that's a lot to go through, of course, and then to know that there are some that are sitting around is something.
And for, in some cases, 10 years, is that where we're at? Laura, I know there's been lots of reports in Chicago about almost a decade of a backlog of kits.
Yeah, and you know, I think it depends in certain areas. We can't say that necessarily for statewide, but there have been that, and it comes on top of also, of course, cuts to rape crisis centers. So this is, I think, folded into a lot of areas where advocates say this needs attention and this does work. So the legislation most definitely taking steps there, but advocates would say a lot more needs to be done.
Let's move on to the Senate race between Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth. There's actually a new spot that's going to start airing today. And it's by a PAC supporting, obviously, Republican U.S. Senator Mark Kirk. It's going to start running in Rockford, Peoria, Champaign, and Springfield. And it attacks Tammy Duckworth for her support of the Iran nuclear deal. Here's some of it.
The Iranian nuclear agreement gave $100 billion to the leading state sponsor of terrorism. Yet Tammy Duckworth voted yes. Now, secret documents reveal that Iran could obtain a nuclear weapon far sooner than we were told. And Duckworth voted yes.
Laura Washington, let's talk about, I know we can talk about this ad specifically, but maybe we should also start with what's the latest on this race between Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth?
Well, absolutely. The latest refers directly to the issue in that ad, and that is that Mark Kirk was this morning was at Buckingham Fountain launching his 2-week bus tour, and he was asked by the media about his position on the presidential race because he has changed his mind a couple of times. First, of course, he was nominally for Donald Trump. Then he rejected Donald Trump and said he would not support him. And then he said he would support General David Petraeus as a write-in, and then he backed off on that and then said he would support General Colin Powell as a write-in. And the Colin Powell issue was directly tied into this issue because Colin Powell, it was for the Iran deal. And so he was asked, well, why would you support Colin Powell if you were against the Iran deal? He said, well, whoops, maybe I don't want to support Colin Powell.
Is that what he said this morning?
About it again this morning.
Okay.
But he's refusing. He'd already said he was going to support Colin Powell. Now he's backed off, and he's refusing to say what he would do. You know, he said he would write in Colin Powell, and it's also been pointed out that write-in votes really don't count in Illinois in terms of our state law. So it's a pretty meaningless decision, and I think he's decided that he's better off not answering that question anymore.
Well, and it's also a tough tightrope that the GOP is walking within Illinois. Certainly, I think Senator Kirk is very illustrative of this, Laura, which is that he wants to appeal to everyone throughout the state, but then he's sort of got the difficulty of Donald Trump to contend with.
Absolutely. And of course, I believe the ad that you just played is going to be targeted in central Illinois and perhaps downstate. And that is because that is more ripe territory for this position on the Iran deal. It's something that where he would be stronger. He would be running stronger, especially as a very much hawkish military guy. But he's got problems, particularly in the Chicago area, and where even though that he is from the Chicago area, because it is so overwhelmingly Democratic. And he's also been named by many national experts as being the most vulnerable seat, Republican seat in the U.S. Senate. So he absolutely had to walk away from Donald Trump, but that puts him in some really murky territory right now in terms of where he really stands.
Laura, you said he's starting this bus tour. It's been very quiet. We've heard virtually nothing from Representative Tammy Duckworth and Senator Kirk outside of Chicago. Do you think now is when, I'm not sure how much Representative Duckworth will be focusing on voters outside of Chicago. It certainly seems like Senator Kirk now is making that move.
He absolutely is. I think this is the slow time of the year when I think you're really starting to see both campaigns gear up as they head for the fall. Of course, we have the state fair going on. Another opportunity for candidates.
They'll come for that, but basically, I mean, it has been really quiet, right, Laura? I mean, it's pretty incredible. I think you have two candidates that both think they are safer, basically trying to get out the vote with their base, doing presumably targeted ads, brochures, those commercials, and that's really how they're running the campaign. I know when we saw, for example, Tammy Duckworth at the Democratic National Convention, she was only there for a day and a half, 2 days, and when asked why, she said, well, it's because I've been so busy campaigning downstate, and I literally gave an LOL.
She hasn't been.
Right, I was like, and where has she been? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Really quickly, Amanda, we just have less than a minute left, but you are at the State Fair. I know you're down around the Illinois State Fair.
Today.
Not
the
yet.
Rain kept me away, and the governor has nothing on his schedule. So no state fair for me, at least as yet today.
But what's going on this week? We've got a couple. This is the big time for politicians.
Yeah, you know, it was classically thought of as the start of campaign season. I think that trajectory has definitely turned, as you're seeing. Obviously, ads have been airing throughout the summer. But, yes, you will definitely have a lot of the big-name politicians down here Wednesday, the Republican Governor's Day, and then Thursday will be Democrats, so we'll be hearing hearing plenty from all of the state legislators and elected officials, candidates, etc.
We look forward to hearing more from Amanda Vinicky, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. She'll be reporting from the State Fair this week. Thanks also to Laura Washington, who's a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. You can also catch her on ABC 7 Chicago, where she's a political analyst. Laura, Amanda, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today on the 21st. Tomorrow, as state universities are getting ready to start their fall terms, University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen will be in studio with me in Champaign. We'll be speaking with some of his counterparts at other state universities as well. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.